listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in another episode of Arab American Identity podcast. And with us is Dr. Hani Bawardi. And Dr., welcome again in the Dearborn blog podcast about Arab American Identity.
Thank you.
This is our second recording of this series. We don't know exactly how many episodes this series will take. We are continuing the conversation with Dr. Hani Bawardi around the topic of his book, The Making of Arab Americans from Syrian Nationalism to U.S. Citizenship. Today's topic is going to be more focused on the Arabic identity, not the Arab American identity, but the Arabic identity, that which the early immigrants have immigrated to the U.S. with. Dr. Hani Bawardi's book, again, the title is The Making of Arab Americans from Syrian Nationalism to U.S. Citizenship. While conventional wisdom points to the Arab-Israeli War of 1967 as the gateway for the founding of the first Arab-American national political organization, such advocacy, in fact, began with the Syrian nationalist movement, which emerged from immigration trends at the turn of the last century. Bringing this long-neglected history to life, The Making of Arab Americans overturns the notion of an Arab population that was too diverse to share common goals. Tracing the forgotten histories of the Free Syria Society, the New Syria Party, the Arab National League, and the Institute of Arab American Affairs, the book restores a timely respect of our understanding of an area then called Syria that comprises modern-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and Palestine. Hani Bawardi examines the numerous Arab American political advocacy organizations that thrived before World War I, showing how they influenced Syrian and Arab nationalism. He further offers an in-depth analysis exploring how World War II helped introduce a new Arab American identity as priorities shifted and the quest for assimilation intensified. In addition, the book enriches our understanding of the years leading to the Cold War by tracing both the Arab National League's transition to the Institute of Arab American Affairs and new campaigns to enhance mutual understanding between the United States and the Middle East. Illustrated with a wealth of previously unpublished photographs, The Making of Arab Americans provide crucial insight for contemporary dialogues. University of Texas Press, 2014. And I hope that all of the listeners interested in this topic to get this book from Amazon and read it while you are listening to these episodes, so you will actually have a more in-depth insight into the conversation. If you have any questions for Dr. Hani Bawardi for the upcoming episodes, please do ask them through any of our social media sites or website. You can find us at dearbornblog.com or any other sites that have are publishing this podcast. Dr. Hani Bawardi, today's topic is of personal importance to me because it is one of the questions that I've been contemplating for a while now. I understand very well, having a background in Islamic studies, the Islamic identity. It is a very solid, clearly defined, supported by texts that are very well preserved, It has a definition for its geography, for its values. The Arabs from the Arabic Peninsula, who were taken by Islam and spread across the old world at that time, merged their Arabic identity with the Islamic identity. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, you have an emergence of a neo-Arabic identity, if I may call it. I feel that it is one of the least defined things. Even discussions I've had with other Arabic thinkers, it seems that there is a lot of question marks around the definition of an Arabic identity. So I want to start with this question. What is the Arabic identity as you understand it?
Hello, everyone. And Wissam, thank you very much. I am very, very appreciative of you taking the time to address those issues and to talk about the book, of course. And I wish more people felt the urgency to revisit what it means to be an Arab, because without that conversation, it would be nearly impossible to arrive at a conceptual framework of what it is to be an Arab American. So with that, you know, times like this, I'm wondering how far back in history do the listeners want to go? And of course, if we go too far back, it becomes more conjecture than historical fact. So let me stick with what we know. What we do know is that the most reliable marker of what it means to be an Arab is the language. And Arabic was referenced by Egyptians as far back as 1800 BC, which is pretty old. They are referred to as desert dwellers who transport water from place to place, very proficient at it. So Arabism then predates Islam and Christianity, just the same. However, Islam, which we'll talk about, we should take these things maybe one thing at a time. Islam, as we all know, overshot the area, geographical areas where Arabic is spoken. So Arabism, Arabic language, Arab narrative, poetry, collective memory predate Islam. However, Islam extends well beyond the Arabic realm. With that, so people spoke Arabic well before the birth of Christ. We know that because one of them converted to Judaism about 1,000 years BC. So you have Arab Jews. They did not speak Hebrew. As a matter of fact, no Jew spoke Hebrew in antiquity. They spoke the language of the region, Aramaic for the most part. That's what Christ is believed to have spoken, or Arabic. So they were Arab Jews, but also non-Jewish Arabs dwelling in from Yemen to all parts of the Arabian Peninsula and beyond. So, and then some of those became Christianized at the hands of the apostles, according to their tradition. The Ghassasana, Taghaliba, Taglibites, and Ghassanite tribes pride themselves on being, you know, Arab and Christian. Famous tribe is Al-Kindi, a mystic or an author, prolific poets like, for example, Umru al-Qais, who believed to have authored the most expressive line of poetry in Arabic language about the horse, was a Christian. And in the vicinity of the early Muslims, the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and forgive me if I don't always say sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, peace upon him, because I want to project myself as a historian first and foremost. But there were Christians in Western Saudi Arabia, in the Hejaz region, when the message spread, preaching the word of the Quran.
So two questions, Doctor, before we proceed with Islam. When you say that there were Arab Jews, that they were Arabic desert dwellers, 1800 BC. How are they defining them as Arabs? Is it by the language?
Because of the language, but this is much too early to have a cultural or a collective identity.
So is the Arabic language that old?
Yes.
Is there an estimate of the age of the Arabic language?
Yeah, because there are references to Arabs and their language and their habits and some of their practices by the ancient Egyptians. And those are among the oldest civilizations in the region, at least. Well, I don't want to ignore what was happening in Africa or the Far East, for that matter. So to give, due attention to other geographical areas in the world, but combine those, Mesopotamia in modern-day Iraq and the ancient Egyptians between them, they laid the foundation for what became later on as Western civilization. But the region is the birthplace of those religions. So it's important to make space for Arabs and Arabism and their language in that region since antiquity. I need to interject something here that the listeners might find useful. In Western discourses, especially in the United States, Arabs, their language, their history, their literary output were written out of history entirely. They are overlooked. They're overlooked in elementary school education. They are non-existent in college education. The Americans, on average, don't know much about the ancient Arabs, for that matter, the contemporary Arabs. So that should be mentioned. So they refer to Arabs as they kind of rolled their history into Islamic, what they call the caliphates, as if it's some abstract, exotic thing, that a fleeting thing. Whereas the Arabs can trace themselves to the Canaanites with some precision. Canaanites dwelled in this area of historic Palestine, for example. The ancient Arabs make references to Yemen as the source of their culture. Qahtan is their father. Canaan is their father in the Syrian regions, and including historic Palestine, for example. So there is continuity and there is contiguity to their cultural memory that was put down on paper pretty early on. All of it awaits translations. All of it awaits sufficient attention on this side of the Atlantic. So Germans and less so British, who came later on, and the French paid some attention to these stories, but frankly, the classical Arabic language is very difficult and impenetrable to Westerners. A few, maybe Roger Allen in the United States and a few others, more so British and German scholars, understand classical Arabic or, at least journalism Arabic. You don't find not even a handful of people who do in this country, the United States, which is a huge, huge shortcoming. It creates this penchant for ignoring all that history because simply no one gave it any attention. We know it. We've read it. We know the poetry of Umar al-Qais, which was preserved through oral histories. In fact, the only record, the basic record of the Torah itself came from oral tradition. The same is true for Arabic poetry before Islam. How do we know so many poetry, poems, for example? I think Antar bin Shaddad is, they call him Shu'ara al-Jahiliya, or Jahiliya is a word that describes pre-Islamic period. Pre-Islamic poetry is well preserved and celebrated and foundational for understanding who we are.
I had to memorize the Mu'allaqa the poem of Imra' al-Qais in my advanced studies of Arabic.
Sure.
So it's still considered a reference for...
We used to call it Nahu and Balagha, and we used to call it nuclear physics. Yeah. This was the hardest class we...
Rocket science. So, Doctor, we got into the time of Islam, the 7th century, and the emergence of Islam, which carried the Arabic with it, and it has expanded in a very fast period over the 100 years, over one century after the death of the Prophet. You have Islam reaching all the way to China, going east, and to the Atlantic, going west. How did that, influence the formation of the Arabic identity, the propagation of the Arabic identity, now that the language is an official language for the religion?
Yeah. Well, we should state clearly that the Christian Arabs remained as is. They just kept speaking Arabic, kept worshipping, Christ, and their religion is an extension of the Torah, which is, Christ came to start a new chapter, and hence Christianity. So those guys dwelled, many historians think they are descendants of the Nabataeans who inhabited this area of Petra in the Jordan desert, etc., etc. But when Islam came, it reinvigorated both Christianity and Judaism because it did not challenge their teachings. There are differences. Some are fundamental, but Islam and Christianity share entirely too much to be at odds. Muslims believe in the virgin birth, for example. They believe that Christ walked the earth and that he was a great prophet. They don't believe that he was crucified. Of course, if they did, they'd be Christians. So, that's the only difference. Whereas in Judaism, Judaism by definition does not believe that Christ is the Messiah. In any case, so when Islam came, the language of the Quran started or ushered in a new chapter in Arab literary history, because the Quran is considered one of those miracles of Islam. The Quran is expressive. It really is a joy to read for anyone who understands the language. I don't want to pretend to be an Islamist or a Muslim or, a pious person myself, but in my native tongue, when I read the Quran, it is an experience. I think all Arabs can attest to that. So there is that. So you have al-Jahiliya, Adab al-Jahiliya, or the literature of pre-Islam. It has a different tone, color, veracity than literature that came after Islam. In addition to the Quran, you have extensive conversations between the Prophet and his inner circle of friends, what is called in Islam al-Sahaba, referred to companions, referred to as hadith. Hadith means conversation. But those conversations were expounded on and studied and explicated, which gave us a tradition all its own, called fiqh, or, Islamic jurisprudence. That actually expanded the boundaries of Arab literary tradition in itself. So, for example, I have one of the oldest documents I have belongs to an archpriest called Basilius Kharbawi. The man is an Orthodox priest. He's Christian, but he's also an Arab. So he has a handwritten manuscript of some 1,100 pages that explains the grammar, the Arabic grammar. And he does it in the classical way. And it reads like hadith almost. So Muslims explicated and explained the grammar of the language based on small stories or anecdotes or examples. That became Nahu later on, or like an advanced or elevated level of the language. But here's a Christian doing the same thing. What does that tell you? It tells you that Christians who were Arabs were influenced in a profound way by Hadith and by Islam. In fact, I'll go as far as saying, and I hope we'll talk about this at some point, the Mahjar literature or the literature of the diaspora. The Prophet by Gibran Khalil Gibran, which sold more than any book in history, reads like, unfolds like Hadith, frankly. It has all those, you know, humanism woven into it. That's what the Hadith does. It became an integral part of the Arabic language. So the Quran, Hadith, and pre-Islamic Arabic tradition all intertwined to give us a new realm of spoken and written Arabic. And of course, you know, putting the Arabic word down on paper is also very important, which became a common practice even before Islam. But as you know, we have copies of the Quran that date back to the period. I mean, within 50 years of the message itself, there are two copies of the Quran that I know of. Other scholars might actually have more information on this. One in Timbuktu was found more recently, and earlier, a German archaeologist, I think, found a copy of the Quran in Yemen, which is only within 70 years of the message itself. So we know the Quran is, the text is static. It has not changed. It was not altered, or at least should not have been, or may not have been.
Also, there is an oral memorization,
of course,
from one generation to the other, that the Arabs, like you said, even the poems have transferred from one generation to the other, preserved due to their emphasis on oral history. But nevertheless, there is talks about, you know, changes, minor changes, or edits, you know, that can, we can leave that for a separate discussion. So, Doctor, so now we have Islam is expanding. You have Islam in North Africa. You have Islam in Spain. You have Persians who have learned Arabic and they've written in Arabic. Turks who have learned Arabic and they're writing in Arabic. And you have the advance all the way to the second Abbasi age, where you have the Mamluks and you have all these small kingdoms that are emerging and disappearing with all kind of different nationalities, but one commonality, which is Islam and Arabic. And then you have the Turks coming and the Ottomans solidifying, consolidating power, and you're reuniting the Islamic world under their Khilafah until they started getting weak later. So during that period, do you want to comment on the influence of that on the Arabic identity before we go deep into the Ottoman rule?
Sure, yeah. I mean, for all Arabs, I think the tradition itself, fiqh itself, concerns Muslims more than Christians, of course, by nature, like Islamic jurisprudence. But this tradition of Hadith influenced both. So you have the most idealized period in Islam, which is Al-Khulafa al-Rashidun, or the rightly guided caliphs, which includes the first four caliphs. During that time, of course, there was a huge split that happened, which created two major traditions in Islam itself, which I think, in my mind, turned Islam into truly a world religion, because it spread eastward through Iran. Persians became Muslims, and Islam, of course, like the great religions, all great religions, accommodated or people's lifestyles and traditions. So I didn't see too much contradiction of, you know, being who they are and still being Muslims. Whereas the nucleus of the Umayyad dynasty was centered in Damascus. It became very powerful. So Sunnis were more numerous than Shi'i. So, and then you have a Shia tradition which took hold in Kufa in Iraq. So beyond the rightly guided caliphs, you have this Umayyad period, which was phenomenally successful, centered in Damascus, which gave way. That was Arabocentric, by the way. So it's controlled by Arabs, and the leadership are all Arabs and in Damascus. That gave way to the Abbasid period. Also, you know, Arabic caliphs who paid attention to cultivating a new leadership from different races who are non-Arabs, like Albanians, what have you. So that was centered in Baghdad, so 750 to about 850 or so, Umayyad period, and then the Abbasids from that date until the area was destroyed by the Mongols in 1254 AD, 50-something AD. You had libraries within 100 years of the message, as you mentioned. You have huge libraries from Baghdad to Syria to the oldest university in the world, Al-Azhar, to Cordoba and Granada and North Africa and Morocco. So Cordoba and Granada were the Umayyads, also had a satellite kingdom which lasted until the age of explorations. I think the Spanish Inquisition, actually. Of course, the Arabs were in the Iberian Peninsula as early as 711 AD. You have libraries there in Baghdad that had 300 to 700,000 volumes on paper, which is unheard of, I think, during the period. So the Arabs, of course, spread all the way to borders of China. And I think it's safe to assume that we learned the technology of making paper from the Chinese. So during the Umayyad and Abbasid period, very early on in Islam, scholars who can translate, and many of those who are Christian and Jews and Armenians for that matter, they worked in houses of wisdom, as they were called, Buyut al-Hikmah, all over, you know, geographic Syria and Baghdad, translating the Greek classics, the Iliads, Socrates, Plato. If it weren't for them, we wouldn't even know who Socrates is, because those are the works that were later on translated into Latin and subsequently other languages. So we lost a huge wealth of world knowledge when the libraries of Baghdad were destroyed by the Mongols. So what came after that was sort of a chaotic period which made room for different kingdoms that arose. So the Mongols themselves became Muslims. And one of the descendants of Genghis Khan is Tamerlane, for example. And those Turkmen basically took Islam into the Indian subcontinent. That's why you have the Mughal dynasty, you have the Taj Mahal, and amazing contributions towards civilization. And some of those Turkmen, as a matter of fact, spread westward to fill that void that was created in the wake of, you know, Mongol invasion. That was the nucleus as early as, I'd say, 1280s, for what became the Turkish Ottoman Empire. So that took root in the westernmost part of modern-day Turkey, in near today's Istanbul, which became a very important trading post connecting, you know, the Far East with Europe, which made them very wealthy. You don't have navigation to go around, you know, the Horn of Africa at the time. You don't have a way around the Middle East. So all the trading took place through the Middle East. I'd like to stop and backtrack for a second, go back to the early period of Islam, even a few years before Islam. So what little written about was, you know, the Arabs of who became Muslims before, during, and shortly after the spread of the Islamic message in Mecca, from Mecca and Medina, is precious little, especially in Western text. So what you have, again, is a language that is sophisticated enough to accommodate the libraries that were in Alexandria by Alexander the Great. What you also have is a very, very important trading center, which created the concentration of wealth and power, sophistication, with a cultural narrative before, during, and after Islam in that area, Western Saudi Arabia. You have Arabs who had international relations with the African continent and as far east as Indonesia and elsewhere. So we're not talking about a few Bedouins running around who became Muslims and then spread. No, we're talking about a people who filled a cultural void because they amassed a lot of wealth. And that, you know, differential in the wealth is what bothered the Prophet, and the Quran came to redress those inequities in people's lives, for example. But what made Islam a timely message and facilitated its diffusion, first northward to Syria, is a huge war between the Zoroastrians in the east, or Sassanid dynasty, and the Christian Byzantine Empire in the west, centered in Constantinople. And that war was brutal. People were overtaxed, they were killed en masse very often. It was like a world war in the region. So when Islam spread northward, it was welcomed with open arms. So Muslims were invited and welcomed into Jerusalem, contrary to, you know, popular beliefs, which are very wrong about Islam spreading by the edge of the sword. Not quite true at all. Yes, there were conflicts, and yes, conflicts are very brutal, but the custom was, in antiquity, is that if one tribe subdues another tribe, all the men are killed. In fact, hardly anyone is spared. What Islam did when it spread into that chaos of that huge war between the Sassanid and the Byzantine Empire is that it created new rules. It gave sanction to Jews and Christians as people of the book. They paid a poll tax, but they did not have to serve in the army, for example. And that poll tax was not static. It was taken off later on. In any case, they were left as is, as people of the book. So people were not killed systematically because they belonged to a different tribe. That should be mentioned. So that brings us to the Ottoman Empire with the spread of, you know, Islam. So the Abbasid dynasty declined. That chaos basically created an opening for the Ottomans, who usurped Islam. So Orhan, basically Osman and his sons Orhan, and forget what the other son's name is, began to spread the word of Islam on their own as if they are the guardians of Islam. So that was the beginnings of the Ottoman Empire as we know it. And it spread eastward where the wealth was before it spread westward on the European side. So there was Rumeli, or a good sizable section of Eastern Europe was under Ottoman rule. In fact, they, at some point, they reached the gates of Vienna westward. And eastward, their realm was checked by the Persians, basically, at the borders of Iran and Iraq today, in fact. Mm-hmm. And they spread southward to Al-Hijaz, or Western Saudi Arabia. So it included Iraq, all of geographic Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Egypt, and parts of North Africa. It was like an ebb and flow that reached the borders of Morocco. That was the Ottoman Empire, which lasted until World War I. And the Ottomans caught a big break when they beat the Fatimids, I think, in 1517 by using gunpowder, cannons. And they spread their influence into Egypt. That marked the early modern period.
Yes, so thank you, Doctor, for this journey over 1,000 years. Just a comment about the early Islam moving forward is that one of the things that Islam particularly has done to the Arabic culture, quote unquote, is that most of the characteristics of the Arabic culture were kind of Islamicized. They were adopted by Islam, brought into Islam, maybe a little bit مع التهذيب, يعني they used to say, يعني it was edited and formatted to fit into Islam, but it was adapted into Islam. For example, the generosity that was a cultural habit of Arabs was adopted by Islam as an Islamic good trait, although it was refined from the Arabic exaggerated that trait, and other traits, النفس في التهلكة, throwing yourself into what you believe in, the تعصب للقبيلة, the how do you say this in English?
Asbaya actually is a big theory in sociology. Asbaya is like tribal affiliation.
Mm-hmm. So that tribal affiliation was converted into Islamic affiliation,
to more loyalty, religious. If you will.
Yeah, loyalty to religion instead of loyalty to the tribe. Although the Prophet and early Islam struggled with breaking this tribal mentality, it remains a question whether it actually succeeded in doing so or not, given that one tribe has ruled for the next few hundred years. So when a Muslim started moving, an Arab started moving as a Muslim at that time with having all his characters becoming Islamic characters, and when a person converts from a different culture, he or she also starts having these similar traits that Islam now is teaching. And this is where there was an intermix between Arab as a culture and Arabic, so that you have that non-Arabic person now learning and speaking Arabic, taking some of these characteristics because they are exported by Islam, and pretty much you can call them Arabs. And many of the Arabs of today, they have, you know, backgrounds, Turkish backgrounds, Persian backgrounds, Indian backgrounds, all kind of different backgrounds, which brings the question of how do you define an Arab person now, coming to the end of the Ottoman Empire rule, where Islamic rule has fallen down, the Islamic identity started to fall down, and after over what, 1,000, about 1,300, what is it, how many years, we're talking about 1,300 years of Islamic rule. Now you're shedding that layer and you're going back to the Arabic layer. What is left of it, and how do you define it after that?
Well, I don't think, I mean, Arabism predates Islam, but Islam subsumed Arabism. And I don't think they were mutually exclusive for even a moment. They were never. Despite the fact that the Ottomans, who are Turkmen, who are Turkish speakers, they ruled over much of the Arab world as we know it today, minus Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula, the interior. They failed in Turkifying Arab society. They tried, believe me, they did. And many Arabs, in fact, some of the early immigrants, spoke Turkish, along with Greek, because they went to Greek seminaries. They knew survival English at a minimum because of the American schools there. And they spoke a little French in addition to Arabic. Many of them did. But Arab identity itself, the fact that they spoke Arabic and they remembered al-mu'allaqat, as we call them, the hanging poets, which are predate Islam, and post-Islamic poetry, which is extremely rich period. I mean, you have mystics that the West is studying. We're talking about Avicenna or Ibn Sina, Averroes, Ibn Rushd, Al-Ghazali. We're talking about, you know, the father of modern anthropology or sociology, Al-Jahiz, those are studied. Al-Ma'arri, for example, Abu al-Ala al-Ma'arri, al-Ma'arri, or al-Mutanabbi. Westerners study those personalities very, very carefully. All these are Muslim scholars who gave the world many inventions and advances in all fields, astronomy, medicine, algebra. Jabir bin Hayyad is the father of algebra. They gave the world the numerals, the principle of the zero, based on, you know, Indian practices, but they wrote it down on paper. So you don't have to use, you know, Roman numerals, which are almost impossible to work with when it comes to multiplications, etc., etc. So the numerals we use in English today are Arabic numerals. That's what they're called, Arabic numerals, on the clock or wherever you find them. So that was done in the name, not in the name of religion, not in the name of specific culture, but the people who were contributors that made the Industrial Revolution even possible were very often Muslims or Arabs. And those terms are not mutually exclusive. You can find among them many Jews. You can find Al-Fasi actually mentored a Jewish mystic in Spain and North Africa. So you can find Christians, Kurds. You might even find an Armenian who did translations and authored this, you know, became an important scholar in his own right. So it was a fluid space that was ruled by majority, overwhelming majority of Muslims, but where other scholars of monotheistic faiths practiced. In the East, you have the Yazidis and some Zoroastrians who survive to this day, and they're neither Christian or Muslim or Jewish, for example. They're loosely connected to Islam, who were allowed to exist. In fact, more of them were killed after the chaos of in Iraq, you know, after the American invasion of that country and what happened in Syria, than any other period before that, we think. So, as fluid as the situation is, you still have a functioning identity as Arabs and Muslims. So you're an Arab, regardless of your religion. You're a Muslim, regardless of your linguistic background. So you have an Muslim realm, which subsumed an Arabic realm. But you can draw the line, culturally speaking, between Iraq and Iran, for example. Iraq remains an Arab country, predominantly at least, whereas Iran is Persian.
Predominantly,
yes. Mm. The same with the borders between Syria, for that matter, northern Iraq, with Turkey. So the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, speak Turkish. They're not Arabs. They don't have to be Arabs, but they are Muslims. So the commonalities between them and Syrian Muslims are huge. There's a lot of influence. I mean, the Turks, before they declined, they contributed to the region's advancement and in all fields, administration especially. In fact, the Arabs themselves borrowed a great deal from the Zoroastrians or the Persians in terms of administrative techniques, how to keep archives, things like that. The word archives is an Arabic word.
Right, as early as Umar ibn al-Khattab. Yeah.
Of course, yeah. So you have an Arab identity that is functioning, that is cohesive within a Muslim realm. Yet you have a worldwide Islamic identity also that adheres to no single language except the language of the Quran. And of course, that was explicated and explained and taught in the local language, in Persian, in Turkish, and every language on the planet just about. I hope that kind of addresses what you're getting at.
Right. So it brings us to the question of this episode. And we are running out of time for this episode. But it brings us into this concluding. So we are at the decline of the Turkish Empire. We are at between 1900 and 1905, and now there's an emergence of the Arabic identity. How do you define the Arabic person today?
Well,
who do you consider an Arabic person? How does a person know that they are an Arabic person?
You're referring to a period called Al-Nahda, which is Renaissance or Arab cultural and political awakening, Al-Nahda. And it's important to backtrack a little bit to the start of the 19th century to demarcate that. So let me ask you, how much time do we have?
Okay. So let's actually try to wrap up this episode.
Okay.
And then we will restart at this point with the next episode, talking about, I think you're going to start with colonialism, correct?
Even before.
Okay.
What we might do next time is start with what is called Ottoman Tanzimat or reforms and capitulations, which is economic treaties with the West. That is the time when the West began to gain the upper hand. So the resurgence of Arab identity as a national cultural identity was commensurate with the decline of the Ottoman period.
That's what we'll start with the next episode. Thank you very much, Dr. Hani Bawardi. And dear listeners, if you have any questions or would like to contribute to the conversation, you'd like us to highlight or shed the light on some of the specific topics, please feel free to leave us comments. Thank you and have a great evening or day.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.